Good evening.
This is K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. And along with K2KEY, Mel, we're going to begin the TechNet. And I guess you guys have heard by now, its main purpose is to get people's questions answered about this fairly complicated hobby called ham radio. We're all in the learning process. We sort of help each other. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Just give me your call letters and name right now. KQLIW listening.
This is KC2QIW. Name is Joe, and no questions at this time.
Joe recognized. Anyone else?
KC2BYZ. Name is Dan. I have a question.
Okay, I think that's Baker, Yankee, Victor, and Dan with a yes. Anyone else? QSC, QRZ. Anybody want to sign into the TechNet? Give me a call that is the name and the confirming yes or no right now.
This is K2GLW, Gordon in Manhattan, signing in, no questions.
Very fun, fine for Gordon in Manhattan. I've heard of that place. And one last call. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Kilo Charlie 2, Oscar Lima Alpha. The name is Mike. No questions. Good evening.
Opening all this is KEY.
Mike and Mel recognized. Anyone else? One last call.
That's a little update on the thing we talked about 2 weeks ago, I think it was, that mysterious HF signal.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell us about that Sirius HF signal, the modern-day equivalent of the woodpecker. What did you find, Bill?
Well, I was doing a ham fest in near Philadelphia. I think it was Wrightsville, the ham fest down there just north of Philly. And I had an HF rig going on my table. Heard that same signal. It sounded like through 80 and 40 meters. So it's not localized here, and I did hear it, 150 or so miles away.
Okay, I was hoping you were going to be able to tell us what was doing it. So all you know is that it's not local. Doesn't surprise me. And depending on the propagation conditions, state of the ionosphere and whatever, the noise could be coming from... let's say a particular town, a substantial portion of the town is wired for broadband over power line, that computer network that uses the computer interfacing network that uses the 110-volt wiring. And so that whole town, towards a signal, can bounce off the ionosphere and come into your town and sound like a really potent signal, very similar to the cumulative leakage index that occurs when you have a cable TV system with a number of leaky cables. You fly your airplane over that particular town, and you're looking down at all of those leaky cables, all of them simultaneously, you can get a real potent signal. And some of the frequencies that are being used by cable TV are supposed to be well shielded, but it happens to fall on the exact same frequencies as some of the FAA communications. So that's the reason why they have this cumulative leakage index, PLI, that if you exceed it, you start paying a fine to the FAA. And a good cable company wants to solve that problem right away. So in the case of BP, a broadband over power line, BP, I think it's capable of making that noise. So you play to some of that noise, and it does have a computer-like characteristic to it. And if you want any add to this, give me your call letters right now. Okay. Looks like we've settled with Don or Dan. I can't read my handwriting. Anyone else with any check-in, give us your call letters or and your name, and it's confirming yes or no if you have a comment for the TechNet. KQLIW listening.
W2PNJ, Bob, with a comment.
Bob recognized. Anyone else?
K2GLW, I originally said no questions. I would like to amend that and ask you a question when you're ready.
Okay, Gordon, you're on the list. And anyone else?
N2MB, no questions. Good evening, Dick.
N2 Moonbound. Guy named Barry. He's thinking of getting into ham radio up there in Far Rockaway. Him and his friend. I'm having some fun with him. Go ahead, Bob. W2PNJ, you've got it.
Many times when a pole is damaged and it has to be replaced, the pole may be owned by the phone company or LIPA. So the pole will get replaced, and meanwhile the phone equipment or whatever is not being done, because depending on who owns the pole, they're the ones that replace it. Many times you'll see so many times like on Jericho Turnpike, a pole hit by a truck. They have a replacement pole in it, and they leave the pole, they'll strap it to the new pole with wire and rope, and there's all the telephone equipment, paraphernalia hanging on it, and it'll take them 6 months to 2 years before they get around to moving their equipment up to the new pole. And that's why you see so many locations, two poles, the new one and the damaged one, because the other utility's got to get around to moving their equipment on the new pole. K2RIW, W2PNJ.
In a case like that, Bob, who does this very important connection of the primary side 13.2 kilovolt ground to that pole peg transformer? The reason that's important to me is because a neighbor of mine across the street 15 years ago had an automobile strike the telephone pole because of flaky grounding of the type I was describing earlier. The 13.2 kilovolts entered his house, burned down his fuse box, and he's very lucky it didn't burn down the house. So, in that case of a sister pole, I'm going to call that, when you strap another one alongside, I'm calling that sistering, who and when double checks that grounding to that bus plate takes place? Back to you, Bob.
That's entirely LIPA's responsibility. Only them, and them alone.
And because they don't know when the pole is really being replaced, I think you're saying the phone company owns the pole, but LIPA has their power wiring on it. So it's the phone company that's replacing the pole eventually, switching over their phone company equipment to the new pole, and then I guess they send some kind of a notice to LIPA saying, now it's time for you to move the transformer and to connect your grounding. Is that approximately what takes place?
Yeah, that's correct. If you look at poles one day, if you walk in the door, you'll see a bell tilt system on a symbol on the pole, or there'll be a LIPA branding iron into the wood of the pole itself. But it'll be clearly marked on who owns the pole, either Marbell or LIPA.
To your knowledge, is there an official number that a diligent person could call if they walk up and down their street and they find out that some of those transformers on top of the pole do not have local grounding? And without that local grounding right at the pole, I think there's a lot of risk to the nearby home and the people inside. I sure wish there was a phone number that we could call and a agency that's in charge of making sure that takes place. Over to you, Bob.
That one call number, the 800 number, they'll get you in, and you'll be able to discuss the problem. And they'll act on it. And, of course, the gear that squeaks the loudest gets the grease. If you call consistently, they will definitely come out. I've called on jobs, strictly as a homeowner, that they have a pilot light on some of the transformers. If the transformer is overloaded, the light will come on showing that it's at its maximum, and they respond to that within a month or two, of course. And no, they'll respond to any query you'll have, because we had a situation because I've been in this house since 68, and of course over the years people put in central air conditioning and increasing the load. on their homes. My neighbor's AC would go on, and I would see the inrush on my kitchen light. So they went up there one evening on a July 4th weekend. The guy came later at night. I had called. He came within a day or two. Went up the pole, and he was drawing, I think, 220 amps on the line right at the coming out of the transformer. So they put in a request to change the pot. That didn't take place until the fall of the same year. But they took out, I think, a 29. They put in a 52 or a 39. I can't recall what it was, but it solved the problem.
If that person was drawing 220 amps, and if he only had 200 amp service, how could that take place, Bob? Go ahead.
No. There's like three, four houses on the same pot.
Okay, so you saw a 220 amp total. I guess you're saying on a transformer that was only rated to say 200. Is that approximately what was taking place?
Yeah. I think it may have been 18 kW pot, and he was drawing over well over 200, 220 amps. With a total connected load, I think at that time that pot had five houses on it, and what they did, they came in, and of course the primary on all the poles, they split the load. Situation now is there's two houses, myself and my neighbors, and we share one transformer, and they added an additional one. They lightened up the load and brought up the voltage, and it's been great ever since.
As I walk up and down the streets near my house in Huntington, Dix Hills area, I think I find roughly two houses per transformer, occasionally three houses per transformer on the older homes. So I guess that's a pretty ancient system that you're describing, where there were five houses on one single, I think you said 58 kilovolt ampere transformer. And by modern day standards, that's really pushing it, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. They came in and they retrofitted the area. They had to do everything by hand because the poles are in the backyard. So they had to lump in the transformers manually. They block and tackle on the pole, and they were able to do the rigging and to bring up the pots and set them in place. And they subdivided the wires up, balanced the load out, and it's been problem-free ever since. Except when storms come, you know, it's the first thing that we lose is the electric.
Yeah, I've had the problem where my electricity goes out and the person next door to me is on a different phase. There's three main wires with the 13.2 kilovolts going down the top of the poles in my area, phase A, B, and C. And I think I'm on the middle phase, and the person next door to me is on the first phase. And he had power when I didn't. That was for a couple of days once. And the difference was really significant to me. I had to be running my generator to keep the house alive. Okay, let's see what Gordon would like to know about. K2GLW, which is interesting. I know a WB2GLW. K2GLW, go right ahead, Gordon. K2LIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, here's... I have a newly acquired Yaesu 7800 dual band, which I use as a base station. And I live in an apartment in Manhattan, and the antenna is a 27-inch mag mount whip, which is mounted on top of an air conditioner just outside the window of the apartment. It brings the reception and transmission are terrific. I'm getting simplex on 5 watts. I was getting simplex like 40 miles away. When I key it, I will sometimes get a hum. My wife's computer is directly in front of the air conditioner. I will sometimes get a hum on the speakers of her computer, and it will sometimes, at full power, cause a slight jump in the picture of the TV screen, which is about 8 feet from the window. Any thoughts or suggestions?
Yeah, I get a very similar thing. If I operate a handy-talky piece of equipment in the shack with me, the loudspeakers that are connected to my computer will sometimes show some funny effects. And that's just simple RF overload nearby. In other words, when the RF signal getting to the wiring of the speaker system is strong enough, the first stage of audio that gets that RF It can't respond to the RF, but it can respond to the envelope of the RF. I'll explain that. In other words, the audio stage is intended to take 50 hertz to 2.5 KC audio, amplify it, and eventually send it to the loudspeakers. If the RF is strong enough, that very first stage, the emitter-based junction, acts as a RF rectifying diode. And it's a good thing that you're running FM. If you were running amplitude modulation, the audio would be coming out of the loudspeakers instead of just hum. So the fact that your radio transmitter is working efficiently, and the fact that it's got a nearby antenna only a small number of feet away, is creating this pickup. You're about to ask, what can you do about it? Once you recognize that the wiring that goes between your computer and that loudspeaker system is probably acting like an antenna, you can try dressing the wire in a different way, laying it, changing the routing of the wiring, or changing the location of the speakers, particularly if you can get the wiring to be at right angles to the polarization coming out of your antenna. Your antenna is primarily vertically polarized, and if you could make that wire more horizontal instead of vertical, that would help. You could also put ferrite beads on the wire. What the ferrite beads do, and there's a crampon ferrite device you can buy, which acts like an RF choke, and you would locate that RF choke as close as possible to the amplifier that's amplifying the audio that goes to the loudspeaker. A little bit of experimentation would be required. But with that ferrite ring around the wiring, it acts as an RF choke. The current no longer flows down the wire, and therefore it doesn't get into that first transistor and get rectified. The next step beyond that would be to install a real filter. In the case of a telephone circuit, people who get radio frequency interference into their telephone can buy a kind of a filter which has the telephone jack on each end, male on one end and female on the other end, and you simply disconnect the wire from the telephone, connect it into the filter, connect the pendant cable coming out of the filter into the telephone, and it's both a combination of choke plus bypass capacitor. You probably don't want to start getting into the actual circuitry of your audio amplifier system and putting in 1,000 picofarad, 0.001 disc ceramic capacitors between each one of the wires and ground. That would make a huge improvement, particularly guys that get a power supply. Every so often, a 12-volt power supply becomes RF sensitive, and that when a transmission takes place, the RF energy being picked up by the 12-volt wiring gets rectified by one of the early stages that's trying to sense whether or not the 12 volts is high or low, and it creates a phony voltage, which then makes the power supply go to some other potential, like it might go down to 11 or up to 15, so to speak, in the presence of RF, and putting disc ceramic bypass capacitors in the right place around the power supply can make a drastic improvement. I've had to do that once in the past for me. So as you can see, the wiring acts as an antenna. When you turn off your television set, a lot of people don't know this, you'll know that the television set never turns off completely. There's a power supply in there running continuously just for the infrared pickup, obvious by your remote control, which is either RF or infrared. Infrared is the most popular nowadays, but some of them are RF. That infrared receiver or the RF receiver is continuously being powered, and so that's how, even though the set is off, your remote control can turn it on. You'd be amazed how many people don't know that. And in many television sets, the audio system never goes off. The power supply that powers the infrared receiver and the RF remote control receiver also goes to the audio system. So there's an amazing number of guys who become very surprised that television is, in their mind, thoroughly turned off. Well, the plug is still on the wall, and so that power supply is still running. So the television is off, but a ham down the street or next door starts talking over his ham radio, and it comes out of their loudspeakers. And they say, how can this be? The set's not turned on. Well, the audio is running. And in some cases, the ham pickup into the loudspeaker is better when the set is turned off than when the set is turned on. When the set is turned on, the circuit that feeds audio into the loudspeaker amplifier, it being active, has a lower impedance and acts differently. When the set is turned off, that portion of the television set becomes an open circuit, and therefore it's easier to develop RF energy across the wiring that goes to that amplifier that's in the loudspeaker that's continuously running. I think part of the reason why many a television set does not turn off its audio is the fact that each time the audio system got turned on and off, it would make a popping sound coming out of the loudspeaker. By it running continuously, when the television set is turned on with a remote control, you don't hear that pop. So, maybe that helps a little bit, Gordon. K2GLW, K2RIW in the SECNAT.
All right. First of all, is it doing any harm to any of the systems, the fact that I'm getting that slight hum?
Almost no. In other words, 99.9% of the time, no harm at all. The amount of RF energy from your antenna that's getting into the wiring of the television set or the computer is probably way below a microwatt. And so, can a microwatt do damage? No way. With extremely rare exception, no, it can't do any damage. It's an annoyance, but it's not doing damage. And by you changing the routing of the wiring and or putting on the choking devices, you can make it stop happening if you wanted to. You could also increase the distance between the radio transmitter and the affected piece of equipment. If, for instance, there was another air conditioner or a radiator or whatever in another part of the house where you could put the mag mount antenna and increase the distance to the affected piece of equipment, that would drastically lower it. That's an inverse square law phenomenon. Whenever you increase the distance, every time you double the distance between you and the source of a radio signal, you get one quarter of the signal. Increase the distance by 10 times, you get 1/100th of the signal. Increase the distance by 2 to 1, you get one quarter of the signal. Whatever the new distance is compared to the old, that ratio, you square it, and it tells you the amount of a signal you get. It's called the inverse square law. Back to you, Gordon.
Okay, two final questions. My wife has a cable modem box on top of her computer. She swears that it has been turned off a couple times, and she wonders if my transmissions are doing it. And the final question is it in any way dangerous for her to sit at her computer? The antenna is outside the window a distance of about 3 or 4 feet from her. Is there any danger to her if she works at her computer while I'm using the radio?
How many watts output from your radio, Gordon? Is that a handy talkie you're talking about, Fred?
No, this is a it's a mobile/base station with a max of 50 watts.
Okay, so what you're now asking is 50 watts and 3 feet of distance. That's not super safe. I'm going to go through the numbers on that one right now. What's the highest band that you radiate 50 watts on?
I guess it's a max of 50 on 2 meter and a max of 40 on 440.
Do you use any frequencies below 2 meters?
No, that's it's a 2 meter 440 dual band.
Okay. That's going to take me about 60 seconds to do that calculation as to what power flux density is likely. The antenna itself is a quarter wave ground plane or a 5/8 wave whip system. Gordon, go ahead.
It's a 27-inch mag mount. I haven't done the math myself to know. And the metal housing of the air conditioner is serving as a ground plane.
Okay. Stand by a minute. It's going to take me about 60 seconds. Okay. Rough guess. She's being exposed to about 2.7 milliwatts per square centimeter. And the safe limit used to be 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. Lately it has been lowered to 1 milliwatt per square centimeter for a uninformed receiving person, so to speak. So you are roughly at the threshold of alarm if you made transmissions for 6,000 minutes. For your wife to be at risk, the way the radio frequency biohazard works is it recognizes the fact that the most vulnerable part of a human being is the eye, and heating of the eye is the mechanism that could, in theory, create damage. A cataract is a possible causative problem if you are exposed to, let me pick a number, 100 milliwatts per square centimeter for 6,000 minutes. That was the number that was derived by doing an experiment on rabbits. It was the red eye of a white rabbit that they actually discovered that 6 or 10 minutes worth of exposure at 100 milliwatts per square centimeter was right at the threshold where that rabbit, who is clamped into a fixture and can't move and can't close his eye, would eventually develop a cataract. There's a whole bunch of safety factors built into that. We're not using 100 milliwatts. We used to use 10. We're now using 1. So that's 100-to-1 safety factor. Second of all, the human being isn't sitting with his head unmovable, with his eye clamped open. A real human being is blinking his eye, he's moving around, and you're probably not making a full power transmission for 6 solid minutes. But if you did, you would be at the threshold of alarm of the current American standard. So that's approximately where you stand as I see it, Gordon. K2GLW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I have not been transmitting while she's working at his computer just as a general policy. And I assume if I do not transmit, there is no danger.
That's certainly true. So, by the way, what is the distance that you are from that antenna when you're transmitting 50 watts into it?
Oh, a minimum of 10 feet.
Okay. 3 feet versus 10 feet is another 10-to-1 safety factor. I think you've got no problem. But if you were within 3 watts, if you're within 3 feet of an antenna transmitting 50 watts, you are right at the threshold of alarm. If you make 6 solid minute transmissions with your face aimed in that direction, not blinking your eyes, I mean, it takes a whole comedy of errors, and there's a number of safety factors built into that rating. But still, that's what the rating is. And every time you double the distance between you and that transmitter, you're going to be getting 1/4 of that power. Roughly 1 milliwatt per square centimeter is now considered the threshold of alarm at VHF frequencies. At lower frequencies, like 80 meters, the amount of power required to create an alarm is much higher. At lower frequencies, the RF energy flows right through you with no real interception. Between 30 and 300 megacycles is the most significant frequency region, because 30 to 300 megs, most of the RF energy striking the human being does become absorbed and turned into heat. And it's that heat, if the body cannot dissipate the heat correctly, that can create the possible harm. The eye has an extremely slow rate at which fluid flows through the eye. So the eye is the most vulnerable organ because it can't tolerate accelerated temperatures and doesn't have a completely natural cooling system. Common sense would lead you to believe a person running a cell phone clamped up against his ear, transmitting 1/3 of a watt, a half inch or 1/4 inch away from his head, you would think that would really be capable of creating brain damage. Believe it or not, it's not. There's a prodigious amount of blood flow through your brain, which is a beautiful cooling system, like a radiator, if you know what I mean. It uses the rest of the body where all the blood is flowing through to cool off the blood that has been excessively heated. So brain material can take a lot of excess heating, but the eye cannot. The way companies are now redesigning cell phones, because of something called the HAC spec, H-A-C, which stands for Hearing Aid Compatibility. Cell phones used to have the antenna very close to the ear, and for a person who wears an internal hearing aid, the kind that's inside of the ear, the early hearing aids used to have a significant amount of RF sensitivity. And the net effect was a person gets on his cell phone, and as he walks down the street and gets further and further away from the cell site, because it's a power managed system. Every fraction of a second, the cell site transmitter is giving orders in digital to your cell site, to your cell phone that's in your hand. It's continuously getting orders every fraction of a second, say go up or go down or stay where you are, in power output. So as you're walking down the street and you're getting further away from the cell site, your handy talkie, your cell phone in your hand, is increasing in power output. And what has happened in the past is that as the person walks away from the cell site and the power output of the cell phone goes up, eventually the RF energy being picked up by the hearing aid in his ear starts blocking the audio, and he can no longer hear the audio coming out of the loudspeaker of the cell phone that's in his hand. That's called the HAC requirement, hearing aid compatibility. And so now cell phones are trying to redesign their cell phone to get around that. The way they get around that is that on many cell phones, Motorola among other brands, Motorola and I think both Nokia are also doing this, the antenna that used to be a little whip sticking out of the top of the cell phone near your ear is now a hidden antenna, which if you take the cell phone apart, it looks like a gold-plated paperclip. A gold-plated paperclip-shaped object, which is the transmitting antenna for the cell phone, is now located at the bottom of the cell phone near the microphone. That gives it the greatest amount of distance from the ear, and therefore the greatest amount of distance from the hearing aid, and that's how they're meeting the HAC requirement. But you get a little kick out of that one, Gordon. K2GLW and company, K2LAW on the TechNet.
One final thought. The antenna is outside. There's a window between where my wife's computer is and the antenna. Does that make any difference?
Very little difference, Gordon. At both 144 megacycles and 450 megacycles, that window is 98% transparent to RF energy. If there was a metal screen, a bug screen on that window, yes, that would act as a shield. But if it's just a storm window plus a regular window without the screening, and sometimes people have screenings to keep out bugs, which is made out of plastic, which is, again, completely transparent. So if your window has got the wooden around the perimeter and it's got glass in the center, the glass portion is very transparent. If it's got aluminum around the edges, it's a little bit less transparent, but the difference is not very significant. And so you have to think like RF, not like optical. To a person doing an optical test, the wall looks opaque. If you pull down the shade or you close the Venetian blinds, again, optically, you think you've created a blockage between you and what's on the other side of that window. To a vertically polarized signal, the horizontal metal flats of a Venetian blind are almost 90-some-odd percent transparent, and about the only thing that would really act as a shield would be the aluminum or copper screening that might be a bug screen. Back to you, Gordon.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much for the answers. Much appreciated. And this is K2GLW. I'll be standing by and let you field some other questions.
W2PNJ.
Go ahead, Bob.
Back in the 60s and 70s, was that level at 10 milliwatts per centimeter squared?
You're absolutely right. The 10 milliwatts per square centimeter used to be the radio frequency biohazard set by the ANSI report, American National Standards Institute. The C95 report, it's called, Charlie 95, and I think it's now up to Rev F or Rev Golf, I think it is, and they've now recently lowered it to 1 milliwatt per square centimeter. It used to have a 10-to-1 safety standard. As I said, the testing that was really done on a real animal was a clamped-down poor rabbit, and they eventually fogged over his eye with 100 milliwatts per square centimeter. You can read about this in some of the very early issues of the IRE proceedings. And so they made a 10-to-1 cut down from that, said that it was 10 milliwatts per square centimeter was safe for humans, and there's been all kinds of screaming and hollering about whether or not that's proper, because for a lot of years the Soviet Union had a rating for their community which is a lot lower than ours. The Radio Frequency Biohazard Board for the United Kingdom has ratings that are very similar to us in the United States, but as I said, the Soviet Union had a very much lower number. However, they did not honor that number. Their high-frequency shortwave stations, the personnel were being exposed to a greater number. Also, there were radio transmitters that were specifically aimed at the American embassy in Moscow, and I think they were bathing the American embassy at 3 milliwatts per square centimeter. It was below our standard, but way above their standard. And we have reason to believe that they were doing that in order to light up the audio listening devices that were so located there. One of the big mistakes that was made is that the United States allowed a foreign government to construct the building that became the American embassy in Moscow. My goodness, was that naive. In theory, every single nail in that building was suspect. I have talked to people who had to debug that building. And boy, they had to literally check every single nail, and a significant number of them were radio sensitive, shall we say. There's a whole story about that one. Back to you, Bob. W2PNJ, K2LIW.
Okay, I worked for a company back between 59 and 68. They made what they called a densiometer, which they made, sold quite a bit of units to the Air Force. And I remember seeing that the meter showed, I think it was 10 milliwatts per centimeter squared as that threshold level. And also General Microwave came out with a unit, similar type of a unit back then. So I didn't realize that they lowered the threshold level. Could be here. Okay, over to you, K2RIWW2PNJ.
Yeah, it turns out that the Airborne Instruments Laboratory bought a whole lot of those general instrument radiation hazard meters, radiation hazard monitors, and they were placed into a laboratory where high-power transmitters were located that were being used for testing the electronics that went into the B-1 airplane, the B-1 bomber. AIL was producing that that equipment, and the equipment was being put together in something that was called a DSIS lab laboratory, DSIS, Defensive Systems Installation Facility. That was the name of the laboratory, DSIS Laboratory, Defensive Systems Installation Facility. It was an extremely large screen room that was laid out exactly like the airplane. So you installed all of the boxes in racks as if you were installing them on the airplane, but you were really putting them in this great big screen room. There was an incident that occurred in roughly 1996, which I had a hand in investigating what took place. A particular piece of waveguide on an X-band transmitter, which had quite a strong amount of power coming out of it, the piece of waveguide went into a dummy load. The dummy load was being misused. The transmitter was supposed to have a low duty factor, complicated signal coming out of it. The software had an error. The transmitter was commanded into full power output, key down CW, for many minutes. The dummy load became overheated. The soft solder joint that was on the waveguide to the dummy load melted, and the waveguide flopped off and dropped down to the floor. A piece of waveguide on X-band is a good antenna. It only has a 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio. So therefore, 98% of the power coming out of the transmitter was being radiated by that open piece of waveguide into the room. The RF energy in the room was reflecting off the metal walls because it was a screen room. The only thing in the room that could absorb the RF energy was the human being. They were the hamburger in the microwave oven, if you know what I mean. The way a good buddy of mine, I can't think of his name right now, discovered something was wrong, is that there was a spectrum analyzer sitting in the middle of the room, turned on, but there was nothing connected to the front panel. He saw a signal on the screen, at the top of the screen of the spectrum analyzer. And he said, you know, that doesn't look right. How in the world is that signal getting on the spectrum analyzer with nothing connected to the front panel? It was coming through the shielding of the metal case of the spectrum analyzer and appearing on the screen. He said that doesn't look good. We found out later on that that occurred about 5 minutes into the incident. He ran over to the wall, hit the great big red button, which is the panic button, that turned everything off. And then we did quite a bit of an investigation as to what happened. We asked everybody, where were you standing? we really wanted to know how many feet they were away from that melted down piece of waveguide. And it turns out one man or two people were relatively close to that position, but they only walked by it for a brief period of time. They were probably there for 30 seconds and then walked into some other location. Each of the people who were in the room had eye examinations every 6 months for the next quite a number of years. None of them had any recognizable detriment from the incident. What I did to duplicate what was going on was to pick up a radiation hazard meter, told the people, everyone to clear out of the room. From on the outside of the room, they remotely controlled the transmitter and turned it on. I opened the door to the room, had the radiation hazard meter in my hand, and I started walking into the room. And as I started walking into the room, I was only a few feet into the room, and I was watching the needles go up and down, cyclically, every time I moved a half wavelength. And I got, I guess within 5 feet of that piece of waveguide when I hit the biohazard standard, if you know what I mean. So I didn't want to go any closer than that. I was in the room for about 15 seconds total doing that test. Kind of a fun thing to do. As I said, the whole room was a microwave oven, and the people in it with a piece of hamburger. You probably get a kick out of that whole story, Bob. W2PNJ for any of the comments. K2RIW in the TechNet.
They found out, I think, up in the Alaska, the first alert area, when they were monitoring the Soviet Union. The guys were standing in front of the dishes to keep warm from the RF. And it turns out that they also became sterile besides getting cataracts.
Yeah, you're talking about either the DEW line or the BMUSE line. DEW line stands for DEW, Distant Early Warning. That was the early system, and the later system, BMUSE, Ballistic Missile Early Warning System, BMEWS, pronounced BMUSE. These were 120-foot high, great big billboard reflector antenna system with a high-power feed horn feeding it, and those guys were standing in front of the feed horn and experienced the RF heating. And yes, how many of those people really experienced damage and how many people were making false claims is a little bit controversial, but it is certainly not a safe thing to do. When you're in an Arctic area and you're in places where it's minus 30 and minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, and you're quite cold even though you're well-dressed, and if you sit in front of a RF source to the point where you feel comfortably warm, it could very well be extremely far above the point where your eyes are possibly being damaged and your reproductive organs, I don't think, can be easily damaged. I think temporary sterility is the main thing that happens. As I said before, the most vulnerable part of a human being are the eyes to RF energy. The second most vulnerable part are the reproductive organs. It's kind of amazing to some people that the very delicate portions of the reproductive organs of a male, why in the world are they on the outside of the body? Well, the reason for that is that the gonads do not make a live sperm if they were at 98.6. I think they got to be at something like 96 or 95 degrees Fahrenheit. That's why they're on the outside of the body, to be cooled. And if RF energy is aimed at them and they're being kept at a temperature like 98.6 or above, it could create at least temporary sterility. Permanent sterility, I think, is a lot less likely to happen. But temporary sterility during that period of exposure is something to be considered. To your knowledge, Bob, were people making valid claims that were verified that permanent sterility took place from that exposure? Did the articles you read say anything along those lines? W2PNJ, K2LIW.
Negative on that. I've never read anything with regard to permanent sterility. Like you were saying, the main factor was the forming of cataracts. The microwave oven said 2450 megahertz. I believe they still are. Is that true?
Absolutely. 2450 megacycles. And there's nothing magic about that frequency. Some people think that that's a water resonance frequency. It's not. The first frequency where you get water resonance is around 22 gigahertz. 22 gigahertz is the first frequency where you get water resonance. So it's not a resonant phenomenon. What's happening is that a water molecule is a kind of a dipole. In other words, the water molecule at one instant of time, the right-hand side is positive and the left-hand side is negative. You put a water molecule into a strong RF field, the water molecule tries to flip back and forth and follow. It tries to follow each individual cycle of the RF energy, but it does it with a phase lag. That phase lag is like the equivalent of pushing a block across the floor, and you got resistance, and you create heating. And so the lag creates heating, and that is the mechanism by which a microwave oven creates heating. It is the water being heated. You put thoroughly dry bread in your microwave oven alongside of a glass of water. The glass of water will get hot, the bread will stay cold. Dampen the bread, and it'll get hot. It's the water that does the majority of the heating. 2450 megacycles was chosen for a microwave oven simply because that is a license-free frequency that was available at the time. It's high enough in frequency where you can design a good-sized cavity for your food. It's convenient in size. It's multiple wavelengths and dimensions, X, Y, and Z. A magnetron squirts some RF energy in there. The RF energy bounces around in that chamber until the food finally absorbs it. As such, if you're trying to test whether or not your Tupperware is microwavable, make sure when you do the test that there is a cup of water or a glass of water in the microwave oven. If there is not, the problem is that a microwave oven that's thoroughly empty could possibly damage the tube, because now the RF energy has nowhere to go. It finally reflects back to the tube, and the tube has to absorb all the excess heating that would have gone into the food. When you put a glass of water in there, which presents a defined load, then any kind of testing you do of the plastic becomes reasonable without damaging the oven. You put perfect plastic like Teflon in the oven and nothing else, the microwave oven thinks it's empty, and your microwave tube, your magnetron, might be damaged by the process. Second of all, you really are trying to find out what is the loss of your plastic with relative comparison to a known good piece of plastic, or to something that's known, like the water absorption rate, the rate of which RF energy is absorbed by the glass of water. If your microwave oven was perfect, and if you've got a glass of water and a piece of plastic, and the microwave bounces back and forth in the oven five times and finally gets absorbed by the water, and therefore your piece of plastic is being absorbed, is being exposed to the RF energy after five individual bounces. If there was no glass of water, then maybe the radio wave has to bounce 1,000 times before the plastic finally absorbs it. And you'll get the false impression that your plastic finally gets hot and you think your plastic is lossy. It's not a valid test for two reasons, that there isn't a cup of water or a glass of water in the oven. You'd be amazed how many people make that mistake of just putting nothing but the plastic in the oven and they think they're getting a valid test. And if their microwave oven survives that, they're kind of lucky. And I've heard some stories of people who have had to replace the magnetron after doing that kind of a test. Anybody want to make any further comments or questions on all of the above? Give me a call at us right now, K2RAW on the TechNet. Okay, let's see. The only two people who signed in with a question were BYV and GLW. Is there anyone else with a question for the TechNet tonight? If not, then we're going to have Mel go over to his mailbag, which is getting pretty stuffed by now. So that's your opportunity to sign in right now.
Yeah, I got a question in 2MB.
Go ahead, Barry.
Thanks, Dick. Okay, when you were giving the tolerance levels for radiation from the antenna, you never mentioned frequency. Of course, I think that has something to do with it. So there must be a low frequency end where you could possibly get closer to the radiating antenna or something. So could you enlighten us on that in 2MB?
You must have got called away, Barry, because I did say that the most stringent region is 30 to 300 megacycles. Between 30 and 300 megacycles, the so-called VHF region, is where a human being absorbs almost 100% of all the RF energy that strikes you, and it gets converted into heat within the first couple of centimeters of the surface of your body, is where the RF penetrates and gets turned into heat. So 30 to 300 megs is a dangerous region. Lower frequencies are safer. Higher frequencies are safer. In the case of going below 30 megacycles, there's a sliding scale where you're allowed to go to a larger and larger amounts of RF energy. because the lower frequencies go straight through you without being absorbed. The higher frequency energy, above 300 megacycles, the actual breakpoint in the specification occurs at 1500. From 1500 and above, you're allowed 5 times more RF energy, because only 20% gets absorbed, 80% gets reflected right off the surface of your body. Microwave, pound for pound, a 5-to-1, more safe than VHF frequencies. You stand in front of a zoning board and you say those words, and they'll shoo you out of the room. They think you're crazy, because they have convinced each other that microwaves are dangerous. It is RF radiation, that magic word, radiation. We made a big mistake, we radio engineers, way back in the beginning of the century, by calling it RF radiation. As far as the dictionary is concerned, the word radiation is accurate. Radiation means to spread in all directions. That's what a radio wave does do. But we should have called it RF transmission, RF emission, RF signaling. There's a whole lot of words we could have used. Very similar to what happened with the first guys who invented the machine called nuclear magnetic resonance imaging. Nuclear magnetic resonance, MMR, NMR. The word nuclear scared the hell out of people. Therefore, the machine got renamed into MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, not nuclear magnetic resonance. So they took out the word nuclear. We should remove the word radiation for what RF does. There's a big lawsuit going on right now in the town of Bayville in Nassau County, where the town is suing, the people in the town are suing the town government because they want all antennas removed from the town. There is a child in the school who developed cancer, and there is a teacher in the school who developed the cancer. 200 feet away from the school is the water tower. On the top of that water tower are the cell phone antennas, the police antennas, the emergency service antennas, and the fire antennas. The townspeople have erroneously came to the conclusion that those antennas have caused those cancers, and they want all of those antennas removed. The fact that the police, fire, and emergency services and cell phones will no longer work correctly in the town is not being considered by the residents. They simply want those antennas removed. I think they're wrong. Their emphasis is in the right place. They're trying to protect their children. But they're strongly misunderstanding this particular piece of technology. There's a lot more to that story. Back to you, Barry. N2MB, K2LIW.
Okay, real good. What kind of cancer disease do individuals encounter? I think that has a lot to do with, you know, if it's going to be quote-unquote radiation, I think that would involve certain types of cancer, not necessarily all types, so I don't know. And with that, I'll let you keep it, and I'm going to listen. And to Andy.
Yeah, it turns out that of all the reports I've read, I don't know if there is a clear definition of what kind of cancer can be caused by RF exposure. Is it leukemia? Is it lung cancer? Is it brain cancer, glioblastoma, carcinoma? I mean, which one of the zillions of kinds of cancer can be caused by RF energy, and which ones cannot be caused by RF energy? If you did have an extremely large exposure, 50, 100 milliwatts per square centimeter, which is dangerous to an eye, but it is not dangerous to the rest of the body, with the exception of the reproductive organs. So if I expose my arm to 100 milliwatts per square centimeter, and I did it day in and day out, so that my arm experienced excessive heating from that RF exposure, and that's what RF energy does. For 50 or 60 years, the American National Standard Institute, among other respected organizations, has been looking for the non-thermal effect of RF energy, and they haven't found it. In other words, everything that they measure that's reproducible in a laboratory is thermal. RF energy creates heat. And does it create anything but heat? No one is able to really confirm that. But if you do believe that a particular cancer could be caused, and you're doing this experiment by exposing your arm day in and day out, or the arm of a volunteer, or the arm of an animal, and then a skin cancer results. Did the RF energy cause it? Was the rate at which those animals in your test study developed the cancer, is it above the normal rate at which animals at that age level, with that kind of food and that kind of lifestyle, would normally develop cancer? As you can see, there's a whole lot of variables here. I don't know what kind of cancer occurred in Babel at that school, but if we knew the kind of cancer, I'm not sure it would solve the real question. Those townspeople, there are 250 homes in that town. The people in that town have pooled their resources. They are making jokes among each other, saying that as we pay the attorney to sue the town, it's the equivalent of having our taxes go much higher this year. That's an affluent community. They're willing to pay the extra taxes, so to speak, to support the attorney. And I think it's a frivolous lawsuit. Even if they succeeded, the Department of Homeland Security would not allow those antennas to be removed. They have already been told that the Department of Homeland Security, if need be, they will condemn the property, take possession of the property by eminent domain, and put those antennas back. Right now, many communities in Nassau County have only a mediocre report card as far as the Department of Homeland Security is concerned, with reference to interoperable communication between the emergency services on something like a 9/11 event. And if you're going to start taking antennas away from the town, you're doing the exact opposite of what Homeland Security desires. And I'm pretty sure they will not let you do it. So it's going to be a complicated case. My prediction is going to drag on for a long time. I'm relatively sure I know how the outcome is going to come. And I think it's going to be a reasonably large waste of resources. I have relatives who live in that town. I've given them talks on what I know about the subject. And because my relatives in that town want to stay friendly with the town's people, they are going along with the lawsuit and not fighting, not trying to negate it. So we've got kind of a mob rule and posse phenomena going on here, if you know what I mean. There's a posse now trying to round up the desperados in this particular situation. They've got a mindset. If I want to make a little bit of a joke about this, I can say it's almost like an old foggy Western movie where somebody in the audience says, "You can't hang that man without giving him a trial." And someone else will say, "Okay, we're going to give them a trial, and then we'll hang them." It's almost that kind of thinking going on here to some degree. People, their mind is made up, and they don't want to be confused with facts. My relatives have told me, I've been in their house, and they told me they will not use their computer when the child is in the house because the computer has a PCMCIA card plugged into the laptop, which communicates milliwatts of energy on 2.4 gigs by 802.11 wireless communication, and if the child is in the house, they will not turn the computer on. They don't own a microwave oven. They refuse to buy one. They're a little bit skeptical as to whether or not the child should sit in front of the television set. I'm trying to convince them that the energy coming out of all of those antennas on top of the water tower is equivalent to the total energy coming out of a 100-watt light bulb when every one of them is turned on. And those transmitters for the emergency services and the fire and police and whatever, they're typically a couple of second transmissions and then silence for the next 10 minutes. So if every one of them turned on, the amount of energy, the heating effect, is a 100-watt light bulb. So if a 100-watt light bulb is on in the room where the child is located, the child is getting the same amount of heating as if they were located a couple of feet from those antennas and the child had crawled to the top of that water tower. A very unlikely event. But it's a pure heating phenomenon we're talking about. 200 feet away in the school and you're 150 feet lower in altitude from the top of that water tower, is that child in the school at risk? Well, would the child be at risk at that distance from a 100-watt light bulb? That's what it really boils down to. I mean, these are the facts. This is the science. You can tell the residents of the town this, and they say, "No, that's RF radiation. You're wrong." their mind is made up and they don't want to be confused with facts. And